Mike Quincy, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Betsy Thompson. She has been with us before. She's an author, and we are going to discuss her latest book called Love Parent, which covers the development of a child's spiritual growth and awareness and how to be the parent you hope to be. So welcome to the program, Betsy.
Thank you, Mike. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're very welcome indeed. Now, apart from religious groups, I would guess the subject you've chosen for your new book is quite unusual. What inspired you to take that one up?
Well, this was really the first book that I wrote, and it's been rewritten and revised and come up on e-books, but what inspired me was I knew when I acknowledged that I had this gift of being able to talk with spirit, I was talking with a friend of mine, and she was having some parenting issues, and I had also had parenting issues because I had German measles when I was pregnant with my first child, and he was born with a lot of physical difficulties, and so I had questions about raising children, and I didn't have any idea what this book would be like, but I asked Spirit if Spirit would help me write the book, and Spirit said, of course, and I just opened my heart and allowed Spirit to direct the show, so to speak. I had no idea what the chapters would be, but they just fell into place one after another. In fact, I was kind of surprised by how the book began, because I had no idea it was going to come from the point of view that what Spirit's feeling before it even gets here, and how it's planning the journey, and what it hopes to do once it gets here, and how it's chosen everything so carefully, what it looks like, what family it comes through, what nationality it is, what nation it comes from, what characteristics it has, what gifts it has, what challenges it wants, so that it was very reassuring to hear that Spirit has its own agenda, and we don't have to interfere so much with it, that we just have to encourage children to take whatever direction they have. So it was very inspiring to me because I had these difficulties, and it was very inspiring to my friend, and so that's how it began.
Right. So would it also follow, given that the soul that's incoming has that degree of free will choice, that they would be advised on the matter by other spiritual beings, because dependent on what lessons the child wants to learn, it is important to select the correct parents?
Yeah, well, I think absolutely that it of course has the agreement of the parents, because of the parents of through the parent spirit or soul, that it chooses for the reason that, you know, we may not understand, because it may look to us sometimes that a child has come into a home where it's going to have a really hard time, but we don't really know the evolution of that soul in terms of its emotional being and what it has been through before and what it believes will help at this time. So it's about really trusting that energy believes in the journey, whatever it is, and having faith that they know what they're doing, because really, that's true of all of us. I don't have any idea what you came here to find, Mike, and you don't know what I came here to find. And so, you know, why would we know about our children either? And so we have to trust. And when we trust the paths of other people, we tend to trust our own path, because whatever we give to others, then we can enjoy ourselves.
Yes. And indeed, knowing the reasons that connect souls with their chosen parents does, of course, indicate that the parents themselves are also learning something that they came in life for.
Yes, everybody. That's what this book takes the point of view, that birthing into the human game is much more than something happening just in the illusion on the matter level. It's something that's going on, an agreement between the parents and the child for the mutual growth and benefit of both. That we both have something to learn from each other.
Yes. In your own questions to Spirit, did you have the curiosity to ask why, in some circumstances, the birth can be very short? I mean, to the point where people will find it hard to understand, say, that a baby or very young child has actually gained anything from it.
Yes, and I think that question comes up in the book, that how are we to, who are we to say? Who are we to say what that child has gained? I mean, the one idea that really came out of this for me was one strong idea, because there's so much going on now about the idea of abortion and people who are violently for it and violently against it. And what it said to me was that how could spirit, that is, when it, before it gets here, it's all-knowing, how could an all-knowing energy choose to come into an idea that had no chance of fruition? I mean, the soul is all wise, so it would never do that. If it comes here and the mother has an abortion, then the spirit knew that that was going to happen, and it was maybe just practicing, creating for the time that it was really going to come here for an extended stay. And so it's about understanding that this energy, before it comes into this plane of thinking, like humanness, like the illusion, it knows everything about its journey. If it's had 10 lifetimes, it knows every detail of those lifetimes. Mm-hmm. And so it comes here understanding what's going to happen. It's all-knowing. Energy that is enlightened is all-knowing. And so it knows what's going to happen. And so it's not dumb. You know, it's when you say that the soul chose wrongly, what you're saying is that the soul is a dummy. But that's an impossible equation, because the soul it can't possibly be a dummy. It comes from a place where it knows everything. So it's about trusting that each person is, each soul is choosing what it needs, even if it's to come here and not to see the journey through. That it knew that was going to happen, and so it wanted to do that.
Yes, that really means that the parents have a very important part to play, and they equally know what they should do. But since they probably only have that information in their subconscious memory, it's maybe not surprising that parent and child sometimes have a very difficult time together.
Yes. Well, I think I think that being here is about facing the challenges that we thought would help us learn to forgive and move on. I really believe that's what it's all about, because that the planet really needs that right now. So why wouldn't we be coming here to learn what that's all about, of learning to accept, release, and forgive, and remembering that, the challenges that we have. I mean, I can certainly speak from experience, because I had a very challenging mother, And I couldn't, for years couldn't understand why I had chosen this woman, or even after I had heard these ideas, I had difficulty accepting that. So I had to go into my heart and say, well, if I did, let me just make the supposition, if I did choose this woman, what possible reason could there be for that? And I realized that because I was opposed to all her philosophy of life and couldn't agree with her on anything, it forced me to find a philosophy that did work for me. She was kind of a catalyst for me that pushed me to find what did work for me, what I did believe in, what I did respect, what I did admire. And so that way she was a great gift to me, in that she really pushed me to find what I needed to find, because I knew it had nothing to do with what she believed.
Right.
Yeah.
How much do you think karma comes into the choice, bearing in mind that sometimes different souls will incarnate together in a similar family situation? Do you think perhaps that sometimes you could say, in a manner of speaking, that you owe somebody a few favours, so you come together and somebody takes on the brunt of responsibility for you in that way?
I think there's every possibility that exists, Mike. I really do. I think that there's every alternative and every variation on the theme that could possibly exist, because why wouldn't you want the opportunity to do that if you needed it? So yes, I'm sure that happens, and I'm sure many other circumstances are available to whatever that soul needs to learn, or whatever it wants to be able to give that it didn't give before, or receive that it didn't receive before. I mean, it can go both ways. So yes, I think it's absolutely possible, and the soul who chooses it knows that it's the evolution that's needed.
Mm. I don't suppose for one moment the answer to my question would be in your book, because maybe it's not entirely relevant, but nevertheless, I'll ask you, what do you think happens in the case of a miscarriage? I mean, where the soul's concerned.
When the mother miscarries?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that the soul knows that the soul that's coming into, that is in that body, or that created that body, knows that that's going to happen. And
right.
For some reason, the mother wants to go through that, for whatever reason. We don't know why. But I think that the mother who goes through it, if she had the alternative of hearing the idea that the child would never make a choice that wasn't going to come to fulfillment, if it indeed wanted fulfillment, it would help her to deal with it.
I ask that question bearing in mind that I have read some people's opinions that seem to feel that the soul has come into the body, but at the last minute, as you might say, decided not to go ahead with it.
That's possible too. I mean, I think there's every possibility that could happen. We change our minds now. Why wouldn't the soul be, have the same opportunity to change its mind? But I think it's done with the approval of the soul of the mother, because I don't think that the soul, when it's all-knowing, ever does anything that would willfully hurt another or be to the detriment of another. I think that we're here to help each other, even if it doesn't look like we're here to help each other, or it doesn't seem like that all the time. I think we are. And I mean, so I certainly didn't think my mother was helping me when I was a child, but now I see how she did.
Yes, right. Now, just sort of moving on a bit from this very young period in a child's life, in your chapter called First Communication, you were speaking of sharing love at birth and indicating that the child feels everything. Can you enlarge on that idea a bit?
Well, I think that when the child comes here, it still remembers, it still has that the ability to read auras, because when it was before it came, it could read auras. It knew how everybody was feeling. It knew how its friends out of form were feeling just through emotional contact. So it still has some of that ability to read our auras. So it comes here, when it first comes, it may not be able to articulate, obviously it can articulate into words what it's recognizing in your aura, but it can read your aura. Some people actually keep that ability to read auras the whole time they're here, not most of us. But I think it's an ability that we can encourage and make work for us again if we study it and we try to do it. I mean, I think that when I worked for a while to try to see auras around people, I suddenly began to see them. So I think that the child comes here being able to read the auras, and they know what they're feeling. So you have to ask, the parent needs to ask himself, what is the message that I am giving this child when it first gets here? I mean, that child comes here thrilled that it's come into this game and thrilled that it's manifested a body, and it feels it feels about itself that it's a miracle. And you have to ask yourself, are you reassuring this energy that it is a miracle and you believe it too?
Right. So that really explains for me, I think, why often when I see very young children, even still in a fairly babyish stage, they seem to stare at people, and I've noticed it where I have been concerned, very intently.
Yeah.
And you're looking at them, you're thinking, I wonder what they're thinking, because they seem so focused and aware of something. I mean, they really are thinking about it. So
yeah.
What you said really is one explanation for that.
Yeah, they're reading your aura. They're thinking, this is something that children have for a long time, and unless it gets, eventually gets talked, they get talked out of thinking that they can do what they can do. I mean, the whole, my gift when I was, came to me when I was 5 years old, and I wanted to talk to my great-grandmother because my mother was always talking about her, and my mother had loved this woman so much, and even then I was having trouble getting along with my mother, and I thought, well, if I could talk to this woman, and find out more about her. So I talked to her, and I didn't tell anybody I was going to do this, so nobody told me I couldn't. And I'm sure they would have told me I couldn't if I had mentioned it. And so the conversations began, because I thought, why couldn't I do this? And then I thought, yeah, Everybody could do it if I could do it. And so that's when all the when hell broke loose.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, obviously, the very early months and years in a child's life are very important. What is your idea of the best way that parents form a friendship and a loving interaction, I think, as you refer to it?
I think that we want to remember to respect this beautiful energy, because children can feel that respect that you give to them. They can feel everything that you give to them. They can feel your reassurance that they're everything you wanted. They can feel your reassurance that you love them dearly, that you respect their energy, that you respect their journey. The child is, before it comes here, it's asking itself, will I remember what I know now? So it wants to remember that it is this beautiful energy. It wants to remember to take responsibility for its reflection. It wants to remember that it's still this loving energy of God. I would say that word because I believe it's true. They hope that they'll trust their instincts and they'll listen to the optimistic side of their nature. So they're hoping that the parent is going to reinforce this idea. And so this is the way you can remember to honor the child by respecting who they are, what they look like. I mean, be just as happy for that the package that they brought with them as this child obviously was to create it in the first place.
I would think some people looking at the heading of some of your chapters would be a little bit surprised to find one on eating habits. Now, I think in that chapter you talk about developing mutual trust and freedom of selection. Now, if that relates to a very young person's eating habits, do not parents sometimes get very frustrated when they try to get them to eat healthy food and all they want when they get to know it, that is sort of junk food? How do you cope with that?
Well, I think when the child is very young, the parents are in charge of what is available to the child, for one thing. You can't preach to a child to eat healthy food while you eat unhealthy food. That doesn't make sense to a child, and nor should it make sense to a child. That's saying, do what I say, but don't do what I do. And that's how you teach your children not to trust you. So if you want your children to eat healthy food, then make healthy food available to them. If it's the only thing that's available to them when they're young, they'll choose what they need out of that food. You don't have to tell them what they need. They'll choose what they need. But I think it's also, with the child, when a newborn comes and is drinking milk, you can't force the child to drink more milk than it wants to. If it's full, it just falls asleep. It stops and falls asleep. And you have to trust that ability to know what is needed doesn't stop just because the child grows a few years. They still know what they need, and just make healthy food available. And be the example to your children that you want, you have to have healthy food around for yourself if you want them to believe that healthy food is valuable.
Right. Now, you also refer to sibling rivalry and sharing, but if you have one or two young children, how is it you get them to treat one another? I suppose the word is with respect, which would then lead to them having no problems about sharing, whereas, I mean, I can think of an example within my own family relations where an auntie had a single child, and whenever we used to go around visiting, that child was very, very possessive of toys and things like that and didn't want to share at all.
Right. I think you have to show the child that sharing is profitable. If he shares one toy, then you bring him four more to play with. Show him how the universe works, because I believe that whatever you give, you receive. And so why not teach the child this as young as they can possibly be? And if that child knows it's going to be rewarded with more toys because it shares one toy, it's motivated to share. And I think that when you bring up the idea of sibling rivalry, I think that begins, the first seed is planted when a parent says, why can't you be more like your brother or your sister? I think that's the most debilitating thing you can tell your children, because they come here to be themselves. And so that's going to always cause disruptive behavior. And I also would add that when children do argue, which is perfectly normal for them to argue, to find their place in the world, this is how they begin to do that, let them alone and don't interfere with the argument, because as soon as you try to settle an argument between your children, what you're really telling them is that you don't think they're capable of settling their arguments on their own. And then they argue more to try to prove that they are.
Yes, I can see the idea there. Now, I'm sure every parent at some stage has the challenge of guiding their children in the right way when they are discovering their bodily functions and all the little crevices and whatever. Do you ignore that type of thing, or how can you help them?
I think it's, they've come here with the only gadget that is truly fascinating for them for their entire journey, which is the body. And when you think of what the body can do, it's no wonder. It's just like this little completely autonomous bundle of energy that can make its way through this entire journey. And everything that it has is important to the journey, or we wouldn't have it. So every part of the body is an important part of our function here, or it wouldn't exist. And so to ignore one part of the body or another part of the body and call it bad is a really bad message because a child is, a little miracle of functioning cells, and everything is important. It's just a natural, normal thing. So everything has to be looked at. And the child gets these distorted viewpoints from the parents having a distorted viewpoint. So the parents need to ask themselves what they really believe and how they can convey a healthy message. Because whatever they feel the child's going to feel, and they'll feel that at a very early age.
Right. Now, inevitably, we must get to the stage as youngsters where we start getting curious about things and we ask our parents for the answers. And some parents can be rather embarrassed if it's of a very personal nature, and they may be reluctant to give the truthful answer. Now, is there a way to cope with that without the child realizing that you're embarrassed? I mean, can you tell something other than the truth?
Well, I think the children know if you do or not. I mean, I can remember being told that I came here through the stork, and I didn't believe it. And that was the first time that I knew that I couldn't trust my mother's answers. I didn't know what the answer was, but I knew that wasn't the answer.
That sounded a bit better than the gooseberry bush.
That sounded pretty dangerous to me. But I think that the children ask the question that they're ready to hear. So it doesn't mean when they ask where babies come from that you have to go into many details. They aren't ready for details, or they'd be asking the details. They're only asking for one little answer, so that's all you need to give. Just answer the question they ask, and when they're ready for the next question, they'll ask that. If you don't answer your children's questions with the truth, they're going to ask somebody else, and you don't know what that somebody else is going to tell them. Mm-hmm. So why not let them get the truth from you?
Yeah. I suppose the difficulty for parents, though, is that some of them perhaps aren't really equipped to give the right answers. And because they perhaps sometimes don't even know what to say, they probably say silly things. And as you've pointed out, the child would sense or know that they're not being given the correct answers.
Yes. Well, I mean, what those parents need to do is read this book.
Oh, that's a good plug there, yes. Why not, indeed, yes.
Why not, yes.
Okay, now, I mean, being a parent myself, I can understand the nature of your advice in the book.
Yeah.
In a days like we have now, where children are very cosseted and you have all these rules and regulations that go to the point where I think they can't really be themselves. But within your own protection and being your own responsibility, I suppose you can give them a pretty free range to do things. But what do you think about that? I mean, should we let children just go ahead and literally do what they want, even if we have to tell them it's dangerous in some way?
Well, I think there's a difference between judgment and danger. I mean, children, whatever, depending on whatever age they are, when they're very young, for instance, and they want to run out into the street because they're chasing a ball and they don't think about a car, that's something that you have to address. But you don't address it with spanking, because when you address it with spanking, all you're doing is telling them that their curiosity is punishable. So what you want to do is to reenact that situation in an idea that they understand. So take their toys or their cars and their toy cars and show them with the toys, you know, with a little map of the street and the house, and show them that what happens if they run out into the street chasing a ball, that a car comes along and hits them. And children will understand that kind of thing. They're playing with the toys. They're using them. They know what it's all about. So that way they'll think when the ball goes into the street next time, they'll remember the game and they won't run out into the street. But it also is about, you know, respecting their intelligence, because children are probably smarter, a lot smarter than we think they are, and they will understand that explanation. But when they get spanked or punished for doing something that a normal child will do, then it's inappropriate to be punished for something that just a child is just doing because they're curious and they're full of energy and they're rambunctious and they feel like they can do anything. And then when they get to the age where they want to jump off walls and things like that, well, it isn't, you know, you don't want a 3-year-old jumping off a 10-foot wall because the older brother can do it, but you can have them jumping off a 1-foot wall where they can fall down and be safe, and they still have that sense of accomplishment, but they realize that it's much more fun to do something and enjoy it than to do something and suffer for it.
Mm. Well, this, I guess, is where a degree of discipline must come into life. How far do you think parents can go when they discipline their children?
Well, I think that discipline is another name for focused love. I think the child will be disciplined about things that it cares about on its own. I don't think you can force a child to be disciplined. You can only encourage what they already are interested in. Are you talking about that kind of discipline, Mike?
Well, following on the earlier conversation about warning children about things that are dangerous, let's say, for example, they did something that was dangerous, how would you discipline them to teach them not to, say, do that again?
Well, I would say that they are responsible. At that age even, you can say to a child, you tried that, and what happened? You felt pain. So this is what happens when you do something that isn't good for you. You suffer, and then you suffer the consequences. You're teaching the child at a very early age to take responsibility for their actions. Then, you know, if you teach them when they're really young that they are in charge of the choices they make, and if they make a dangerous choice, they're going to suffer the consequences. They burn their hand on the stove, they whatever. When they know they're responsible for it, they're going to think twice whether they do it again. And this idea carries right on up into adolescence, when children have things available to them that the parents can't control, like drugs and alcohol. If they learned at an early age that they were responsible for the choices they made, they're going to take responsibility for that choice too. And if they do it from a choice where they aren't rebelling against the parents, they're actually taking responsibility, they're actually doing it because they want to do it, then when it doesn't work out too well and they suffer the consequences, they know they are responsible to stop as well. But they won't stop if they are rebelling against the parents, and they won't stop when they're rebelling against the parents as a child either, because as soon as they do that, they make the parent right and themselves wrong, and they don't want to be wrong. They want to be right. So you want to make sure that they are making the right decision for themselves so that they can be happy about taking responsibility.
Right.
It's a big idea throughout the whole book, because, you know, when children leave home, they have to be responsible. Nobody's going to be there to pick them up when they fall later on.
Indeed, yes. Now, I'm sure every parent has had the occasion when a child's probably come home from school or been out playing, they're sort of crying their eyes out, and you find out that they've been called names, say, because they've got ginger hair or whatever it is. How do you help a child through that sort of period of where they may be picked on or even bullied?
Yes, well, I think that the children who suffer this being picked on really have the same problem that the child has who is doing the picking on. They're afraid that they don't measure up, and then to reassure themselves that they are okay, they call somebody else not okay. And the children learn this at home, you know, this is a, you know, the home is a breeding ground for behavior, and the child has to learn for herself or himself that it's not okay to be picked on. But if they see this happening in the home, and they see that they're picked on in the home and nobody defends them, they're going to think it's okay to be picked on when they're outside the home. But when you, when this happens to your child, you just teach them that, first of all, to handle it the best way once it's happened is not to blame the teacher or blame the child who's abusing, because if you do that and you come become very vocal about it, you're teaching your children to take revenge, and that's not going to solve anything. So you want to you know, ask what the real cause of the problem. Sometimes something as simple as wearing a certain colored bow in their hair can cause teasing, and if it's as simple as that, you just reassure them that you love the bow and you love the child and you think they're wonderful just the way they are, because that's what children are worried about. Am I okay the way I am? So they need to be reassured by the parents that they are okay, that they're always okay, and that you love them just for who they are.
What do you think of the old expression that little children should be seen and not heard?
I think it's too bad that it exists. I think children, the children that have that reputation are the ones who never get a chance to say anything, and so they're constantly trying to get attention so they can say something. So if you respect your children's opinions from an early age, they won't just talk for the sake of talking.
What about when they hear their parents talking and they want to join in, sort of interrupting the conversation?
I think their opinion should be respected, because if their opinion is respected at an early age, that's a really good beginning for the children to learn to respect other people's opinions. If their opinions are respected, they're going to respect other people's opinions, because the child who knows that its opinion is valuable is going to think other opinions are valuable.
Right. Now, if we interpret the development of a child's spiritual growth as having something to do with their spiritual beliefs, at what point in their life do you think that you can introduce some information about it? I mean, without imposing your own beliefs, but how would you approach that to give them a background to their spirituality?
Well, you can always introduce ideas to them. Just introducing eyes to them doesn't mean that they have to accept them. You know, you can share. The best way to demonstrate what you believe spiritually is to behave as the spiritual person you think you want your child to become. Children do learn from example; they don't learn from words. So, if you're living a life of integrity, your child is learning the biggest spiritual lesson there is. You know, if they're watching you be a bully, they're watching you yell and scream and lose your temper, then that's what the child is learning is okay, because they believe that you're the whole world when they're a child. They think the whole world is you, and however you treat them, they believe the whole world will treat them, because that's their view of life. So it's important that you live the spiritual kind of existence that you want your children to have, because that's how they get it. That's their first introduction to it.
Yes. Now, it must be difficult for step-parents. Do they have a different relationship with step-children?
Well, I think that's individual, but I think that the step only means that there's a step between finding each other. And I think that step-parenting is a microcosm of the world's struggle to love, you know, where there's a lot of ad-libbing that has to happen with a new cast of characters. But I think when two families come together, the most important idea that has to be remembered is that the health of the whole is what has to be held and honored, because it's two separate wholes coming together to form a new whole. And if you don't honor the health of that complete unit, the unit's going to fall apart.
Okay.
I know that from personal experience.
I'm sure a lot of what you're talking about is from personal experience. I suppose you could say, what else would you trust, possibly? Now, what happens when a child becomes a teenager, and maybe the parents have this vision of them perhaps following their parents' careers. They might have been, say, for example, successful doctors or something like that, or solicitors, and they find the child hasn't got the slightest interest. How are they supposed to cope with that?
Well, I think you're asking what really need to ask is how can the child cope with that, because the parent is forgetting that this is an individual person with their own gifts and their own likes and dislikes. And I think that when you try to force your children to go in a direction that you've gone just because you love it, you're setting the seeds of rebellion in your child. I think that's, you may not think you're doing that. You may tell yourself you're doing it because you want your child to have a happy future. But the happy future for the child is in what that child wants to do, not in what you want that child to do. You aren't really loving the child by doing that. You're teaching the child tyranny that I'm only going to love you if you follow a certain path. Mm. And this child has already come here knowing exactly what it needs to do and what it wants to do. It only needs you to encourage that direction. That's all it wants from you, to encourage it to go where it normally naturally feels it's going to have a productive life.
Right. Now, a very difficult time, I'm sure, for parents is maybe more so when they have girls rather than boys. But nevertheless, adolescence can be very trying. Is there a way to approach that lessens the problems?
Well, I think it's that the time is when it's wonderful. These children going to an age where they want to be an adult, and you have to. If you don't allow them to be this teenager, they're going to go in destructive direction to prove that they are turning into an adult. And so this isn't the time to tell them they can't be trusted to act like an adult. This is the time to welcome them into the sisterhood or the brotherhood as the same autonomous being that they are. And this isn't the time to criticize every decision of taste, like things that are so temporary that they're going to have for a couple of months, like a haircut or the skirt or whatever they're wearing. This isn't the time to criticize that. It's the time to praise their individuality. This isn't the time to criticize their leisure hours and what they're doing in it. It's a time to believe that they can use their time constructively, because whatever you believe that to be true about your children, they're going to try to live up to it. So if you are criticizing them for everything, they're going to live up to being the person who's criticized. If you're praising them and welcoming them and honoring them and respecting this phase of their growth, they're going to live up to that.
Yes, indeed. Now, your book certainly covers many aspects of being a parent. But again, a difficult situation must be where you have adopted a child and the child knows. So one would imagine that a child that isn't with its natural parents would have problems through life. How do you approach that?
Well, I think that that children should be told they are adopted as soon as they're old enough to understand that idea. But I think that the one idea that I really loved when I was writing this chapter was that if the desire to adopt a child is in you, the desire to be adopted exists in another. And it's just another way of people getting together, because the child, after all, you have to, from this book viewpoint, that adopted child knew exactly what it was getting into and what it wanted to live, and that's what it wanted to be. This, it wanted to be the child of this parent, these parents, even if it didn't come through the birth canal. So it is parents and children getting away just through a different route.
Well, one reads quite often where children haven't been told they have been adopted, and they form a very strong natural relationship with their parents. But when they do learn that they've been adopted, then somehow it seems to throw a spanner in the works, and then they don't know really then whether they love their parents who adopted them as much, because they feel some pull towards what must be their natural parents. Is that not a very difficult time to deal with?
Well, I think that maybe that if the children are not told until they're grown up, then it's a trust issue for the children, not being told the truth when they were, young enough to know that they were adopted, because to go for years and years and not be told, and then suddenly to be told, would feel, I can understand how a child would feel that they weren't honored, they weren't honored by being told. If they want to find their parents, then I think the best thing parents can do is encourage them to do it. If they really love the child, why wouldn't they want the child to investigate and find a parent? If they really care about the child and the child really cares about the parents, it isn't going to hurt that relationship, it's going to enhance it.
Mm. Yes, I'm sure you're right on that one. Now, there's a school of thought which I'm part of that feels that at the end of 2012 we have an opportunity to ascend, or certainly there is going to be energy around that's going to give us a very big upliftment. Now, looking ahead, would you expect parents to guide their children onto that sort of path? I mean, they're bound to hear of it. What would you do?
I think that children learn from the way, you know, if you're living a life that your children admire, they're going to listen to your ideas about that too. I think it's that most children realize that maybe they don't realize there's a shift, because a lot of children haven't experienced what was happening 20 years ago, but there's been such an enormous shift in mentality and spiritual opening in the last 20 years. I mean, you and I know that, because 20 years ago, people didn't, if you said the word New Age, they looked at you like you were a little bit strange. And, and now it's very out in the open, and there's a huge mass consciousness shift going on in the world. And why not include your note? You can always tell your children what you believe. They don't have to believe it if they don't want to. But if you can respect them enough to include them in the ideas that you believe are true. I mean, sometimes children learn by osmosis without actually agreeing with you outwardly, because sometimes teenagers don't want to agree with you, although that doesn't mean they don't. They just don't want to admit that they do. So just, you know, live what you believe is right and what you believe is happening, and share your ideas, and then don't say, you know, they have to believe it, because you can't force people to believe something anyway. But they'll be interested in what you're doing if they respect you, and they respect your ideas, and you respect their ideas. So I think it's just a matter of sharing what you believe is so, and letting the chips fall where they may. You don't have to, you know, don't look for agreement.
No, right. Now, when your children really get grown up and they get married, and then they have their own difficulties or their problems, do you think their parents should allow them to come running back to them when they're in trouble? Or should they say something like, you're married now, you're grown up, you know, you get on with it yourself?
Well, I think this is probably a problem that happens when the children haven't been forced to take responsibility for themselves at 3 and 4 years old, and then it's a pattern that starts. And the parents make it easy for the children to be forgiven for what they needed to take responsibility for. And then that's a pattern that continues on and continues on and continues on. And why would it end simply when they leave the house if it's been a constant in their lives since they were 3 and 4 years old? So, I mean, I don't want to offer advice on that kind of a situation, because, you know, it's too individual. But it's the idea that if the child doesn't learn to take responsibility for self at the appropriate age, they're going to have to learn to do it on their own. I mean, that's certainly my story. I was so micromanaged as a child that I didn't have the confidence to deal with things on my own. But then life happens, and then you are forced to do it whether you want to do it or not. And it's a lot harder when you're older than when you're younger.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So what do you think about teenagers or older, that start getting involved in drugs? What is the parent's part in that?
Well, I think it's always about respecting the child, and I think that what you need to do is to sit the child down and say, look, I know that drugs are out there, I know that alcohol is out there, and I know that you're going to try it if you want to try it, but what you have to know is that if you do try it, and it doesn't go well for you, you're on your own. You know, one child is not going to disrupt this whole family because they made a bad decision. So if you make a bad decision, you're the one who's going to have to live with it. We're not going to live with it. The school isn't going to live with it. Your friends aren't going to have to live with it. You're the one who has to live with it. And when a child makes a decision to go into drugs from the position where, okay, I'm free to make this decision if I want to, then they know they're free to make another decision if it doesn't go well. So I think it's also that same idea of you can't protect your children from what they're determined to try, but you can instill the idea that they're going to suffer the consequence, and they're the ones who are going to have to get out of it, because they are. Basically, they are. If children get into drugs, no one else can get them out of it but themselves. So they might as well know that ahead of time.
Indeed, yes. Now, obviously, one's children follow the pattern, and most of them get married and have their own children. Do you think that mother-in-laws and father-in-laws have any place in their grandchildren's lives?
Of course I do. Of course I do. Yes, but I know there's a lot of sometimes angst over this because I don't know, in-laws interfering where the children don't want their input, but it's all about that idea of respecting, continuing with this respect that you raised your children, now it's your children's turn to raise their children, and but you can always be there to support them and to love them and to care about the children. Why not? Of course.
Right, good. I mean, it does get to the point, I guess, where because you've been teaching your own children to be responsible for what they're doing, if they get married, I mean, clearly they are then responsible for their own children. But we often hear of stories where their grandparents start interfering, and I suppose that's something you mustn't do. Although, I guess having said that, you can give advice without appearing to try and impose it upon them. But yeah. I think it's the source of a lot of trouble, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is. I think it is. Parents had their time to parent, and now they're grandparents, and the role is different as a grandparent than it is as a parent. You just need to support your children and tell them that you support them and you're there for them if they need you to whatever. And parents can babysit, or they can visit once in a while, but don't impose yourself on the family. If you're not welcome, don't go. Children to your house. Have the children over to your house.
Yes, right. Well, of course, sometimes that is the root of the problem. The children go to their grandparents' house, and when they come back to their own parents, they picked up some bad habits.
Well, parents, their children, grandchildren want to spoil their children, yes, but I think that's you just say, well, that's something you can do at your grandparents' and you can't do here.
Right, yeah, very good answer. Until they say, okay, we want to go and live with our grandparents. Right, Betsy, it's been very interesting talking about this. Is there anything else you would like to add? I mean, I've asked you about the questions that have come to my mind after reading your book, which is very thorough, as is apparent. Is there anything I might have missed out on, or something you would particularly like to add?
Well, I think it's about training your children as soon as possible that they are capable of directing their journey, because after all, I believe they thought up the journey. So you need to give them the freedom to be themselves. They really know what is realistic to achieve and what is not. So all you need to do is respect what your child does well, believe in his abilities and his ambitions. And after all, what more can you give a child? Because if he appreciates his energy and he finds pleasure in his existence, he has everything.
Indeed, yes. Now, just as a sort of side issue here, you mentioned at the beginning that you talked with spirit. Is that something you do now? I mean, or have you sort of set that aside?
Oh, that's what I believe all my writing is about, is allowing spirit to speak through me. So, I mean, I believe that, I didn't do everything that was in this book when I was raising children because I didn't know any better. But I believe that spirit speaks through me and has the message that is trying to get out to people to make their lives easier and more rewarding. And so I finally re-acknowledged this gift when I was in California and almost homeless, and decided that my life needed to be about taking responsibility for myself. And one of the things I took responsibility for was this ability that I had realized I had at five And I said, well, that I did want to take responsibility for the gift, and I did want to share the ideas that would come through it with other people, but I needed a job to support myself. And 3 weeks later, I had the job that I had for the next 18 years in the entertainment business, and supported me so well that I retired 5 years ago to write full-time. And it was almost as if the universe, you know, said to me, well, if you're ready, Betsy, we're ready, and here we go.
And right.
It's been delightful ever since.
And talking of here we go, we are rapidly coming to the end of the program. But there's two things. You can give our listeners your website address and any other information you want. But you might also just add a few comments about what I believe you also have available, which are self-help books.
Yes, well, they can go to my website at www.betsythompson.com. And the first book that comes up is Walking Through Illusion, which is my most recent new book, and it's available on Amazon. And there's another book, which is the first book in that series of books called The Mirror Theory, and that is also available. And then Love Parent is available also in ebooks. And they can, when they go to my website, there are links that go to Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and YouTube, and a blog that I have where I share some of my emotional struggles through my life and how I resolve them. And so they can get to know me a little bit better if they go to my website, www.betsythompson.com.
Right. we better explain, I guess, that Betsy is spelled... I'm getting a bit hoarse here.
Okay. B-E-T-S-Y-T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N.
Right, fine. Because you never know, somebody might not know how Betsy is spelled, and there are different versions of Thompson, aren't they? Some of them without the P.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. I've got a couple of minutes left, which would be ample to give our listeners details of next week's guest. Right, a final question. Is there anything else you would like to add? I think you've covered what is available through your website. Do you accept questions by email by any chance?
Sure, I do. I do. And I could mention one other thing that comes up a lot that seems to have a lot of controversy now in schools, which is the idea of homework. And the message in this book is that homework is the perfect opportunity for children to learn about taking responsibility. So don't try to micromanage them. Don't grade the papers before they're even handed in. Don't demean the work. Shame them into working harder, because that is not birthing an overachiever. That is birthing an underachiever. So let the child handle this responsibility. It's a wonderful opportunity for them to do so. And they will when they know that they are working for themselves and not for their parents, they're probably going to do better.
Wonderful. Well, it's been very nice to talk to you again, Betsy, and we've certainly filled the 55 minutes quite comfortably, and it was very, very interesting. So thank you very much again.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Right, friends, that was... a somewhat unusual subject, a little bit different to most I have. Next week I have my guest as Patty Greer. She had an out-of-the-body experience in the centre of an immense crop circle in Wiltshire, England in 2007. And from that day her perception of reality changed. Since then she's made movies about crop circles, UFOs and 2012. And been most successful, and that obviously is what we're going to discuss when she comes onto my program. And I can assure you Patty Greer is probably one of the most experienced investigators of the crop circle phenomenon. So I hope you can join me, and thank you for being with me today. God bless you all. Thank you.